This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Today we're going to talk about music, specifically why music is important to God. We've just finished production on a new booklet by Ryan Malone, who directs the musical activities of Herbert W. Armstrong College and the Philadelphia Church of God. He's also the host of Music for Life here on Trumpet Radio. And in an upcoming episode, December 17th, he's going to give a synopsis of this booklet called How God Values Music. We're going to have an advance interview with him on today's show. I think you'll find it very interesting. Then we'll shift gears and we'll learn about Chinese intellectual espionage. In a recent case, China was discovered to have stolen trade secrets from a high-end American technology company worth upwards of $8 billion. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. Some analysts say every year Chinese theft of American intellectual property is worth hundreds of billions. What makes this especially interesting is it actually fulfills a specific biblical prophecy. We'll hear a report about this from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. We'll also look at a terrible climatic and weather-related disaster siege that has been hitting Australia in recent days. Dust storms, fire tornadoes, floods, heat waves. We have an interview with trumpet writer Callum Wood, who lives in Australia, about this. And I'll conclude today's show by exposing one reason why your children might not be listening to you as attentively as you would like them to. But let's get to our first interview about music. We have here the director of musical activities at Herbert W. Armstrong College and for the Philadelphia Church of God, Ryan Malone. Hello.
Hi.
So it's got to feel good to have this project. You're holding it in your hands. It's the work of many years of work.
It is.
You know, I'm interested in just your the fact that this booklet represents a lot of study on your part for a long time. You've been playing music your whole life, obviously, but you didn't start out with this scriptural and spiritual view of music. This has developed over time, and this book compiles material you've been putting together for years on this subject. If you can just step back and look at the big picture and talk about how your understanding, your appreciation of this subject has grown over time.
Yeah, well, you know, my parents, being in the Church of God, felt like music was important to develop in me. They saw that I had a proclivity to, you know, be passionate about it and be interested in it. So there was a spiritual component to, you know, me learning music, and it was always stressed that, you know, this is something you can serve God with. But certainly the scriptural importance of it wasn't constantly in the forefront of my mind when I was practicing at age 9 and all that. So certainly as, you know, as I grew and, you know, even serving more, you know, in addition to just what you might call secular performances, serving more in the church as I got older, you know, seeing how really it could benefit and really add to, you know, what was going on in terms of worship, that certainly I became more aware of that, you know, as you grow older. But then, the material contained in this booklet really, you know, just took that to a whole other level, as they say. We came into possession of a lot of materials from Ambassador College, and there was a stack of notes, typed up notes about all the music references in the Bible and some comments on them. And they were, I don't even think there was an author listed with them. And I was looking through those and seeing how, you know, how much they had gone to the effort of trying to describe all of those or discuss, comment on all those things. And so I, of course, Mr. Gerald Fleury has always been stressing the importance of music in, say, the prophetic times, you know, say in the times of Samuel and, you know, the former prophets, I mean, and, you know, in the times of the monarchy under David and Solomon, just because of the parallels with our work. And so he's sort of been stressing that because of those parallels. But to me as a musician, that stands out as well. So all that having been combined and studying that while you know, all this new revelation is coming about, you know, music's importance in the Old Testament. And as I'm reading these notes, you know, we just thought, well, we need to put this in a format that we can look at it more intently. And so we had a class
right
here at the college called Music of the Bible. And that class really forced me to get more in depth with all of those scriptural references to music and how really the Bible really exalts this activity. And it says, in fact, it's an essential commanded component of worshiping God. And so going through all those lectures, you know, over the course of a semester, getting term papers from students to, you know, research various aspects of things, and then even just understanding more of the science and the theory behind what I'd been doing my whole life, mm-hmm. just seeing God's handiwork in that, in the mm-hmm. physics of it all, and the math of it all, and putting all those lectures together, and then eventually writing up those lectures. And this was 7 or 8 years ago.
Right.
And those have just, you know, those have been just sort of sitting on the back burner. We'll refer to them frequently on Music for Life and that type of thing. But it was just recently that Mr. Fleury looked at those again and said, you know, I really think we need to promote this, you know, a little bit more readily.
Yeah. So. And he gave that terrific Key of David program on that. And that was really the impetus for putting the booklet together.
Right.
You mentioned his role in resurrecting some of this. You have these notes. So you're looking at material that had been taught at Ambassador College, and it was a part of, say, that spiritual understanding, that legacy from the Herbert W. Armstrong era, mm-hmm. That basically you picked up the baton and ran with it. And it's been amazing to me. Like, I think of Herbert W. Armstrong maybe as having more of a natural proclivity to some of the cultural aspects of what the work was engaged in. Mm-hmm. He himself played piano,
right.
And just was probably more familiar with that just from, I guess, from cultural experiences that he had had a younger days.
And a musical family as well.
Right, yeah. And Gerald Fleury does not have that kind of a background, except for what he learned as an Ambassador College student and the experiences that he had. He toured with gave tours of the Armstrong or the Ambassador Auditorium and was familiar with it in terms of what Mr. Armstrong had established. But he has championed it in a remarkable way with the mm-hmm. concert series and then just encouraging more of this kind of understanding as you've been bringing it out through your class and these other activities.
Mm-hmm.
How much has your having studied into this changed your approach, the way that you go about your activities as an educator? You're teaching kids all the time. You're a performer, a very accomplished pianist, a composer. Gerald Fleury has had you writing musicals that we can do as part of the activities here on the campus. How much has, say, the spiritual dimension of this infused all of those other activities?
Well, I think it boils down to the importance of what one is doing. And, you know, it's, you know, you look in the Bible and you go by what, you know, what the culture under, say, King David or King Solomon promoted, or under Nehemiah and Ezra. And you just see that they were employing these musicians, and they typically were basically a tribe in terms of the professional musicians who took care of these things, but they were exclusively working on this this activity because it was that important. And so when you see the spiritual component and the spiritual relevance of this activity, that impacts your day-to-day job. It's easier to inspire, you know, a young person involved in an activity where you say, look, this activity it exists in the spirit dimension. It's not a type of something. It's not just a good discipline to teach you certain character traits, but this is something that exists in another realm and God values it. And so that does impact, I mean, that impacts everything in the way the way one writes music, the way one rehearses music, the way one teaches and tries to inspire young people. I mean, I guess that's the short of it, even though that's a really open-ended, you know, question. When you see how what, you know, how God created it, how he created it in his masterpiece of angelic proportions, and how he continues to stress it, you know, and how even, like you said, even if someone is at the helm of the work who didn't necessarily have just a musically saturated upbringing, this man still looks in the Bible, says, this is important. Mm-hmm. I want a booklet on it. I want these programs in place. So, you know, and so that just keeps rumbling forward, you know, even in spite of the size of the church, in spite of the size of the college, in spite of the very small size of the music faculty, mm-hmm. it keeps trucking along.
Right.
because we feel that God's behind it because God values it. And that's what matters.
Yeah, it is exciting when you're talking to a young person and trying to encourage them to practice. And I speak as the father of three children who are involved in music, and just trying to fuel their motivation to realize that they're part of something that goes way, way back. And it, mm-hmm. it really is something that God puts a high value on. So let's just talk a little bit. You have in the booklet a chapter on the origins of music, and you were mentioning some of those details just in what you were just saying, that there is plenty of evidence to show that the real author of this art form is God himself. Talk about that.
Well, there's too many fantastic numbers involved in music to know that it's, or to ignore that it's been designed by a great mathematician. Even the Greek word logos, for, you know, meaning spokesman, it's also the Greek word for ratio. You have the creator of the universe as the mathematician, and he's organizing the distances between stars and planets and things in our solar system as relates to, well, those are the same ratios that we find in our most pleasing intervals when we hear two notes sound together. Those sound good to us, to our minds. So it's the same mind who created it to work with our minds and created to work within the physical realm in that way. You just see, like as David said, I mean, the heavens declare the glory of God, and it says their line, their string, you know, it's gone out, you know, and you could it's vibrating, and it's making these sounds that God can hear and be pleased with. There's just all sorts of details in those origins that are really truly inspiring, and even just our, I guess, psychology, if you will, just how we can even comprehend that, and how God created our ears to hear certain things a certain way and to enjoy certain things, and as has even a physical impact in us and an emotional impact. I'm getting a little bit off the origins here, but you know, I mean, it really goes into all of creation, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
And then on top of that, there's a lot in the Bible that shows that this existed even before human beings were around.
Right. Well, yes, of course. Like I said earlier, the creation of Lucifer and God making him basically an angelic instrument with all these jewels and things, and of course God himself being a musical being, where, you know, Zephaniah says that God sings, and well, God's always existed, so you know his voice has always existed, and so in that sense, music really, you know, it would be hard pressed to find a beginning for this. Mm-hmm. And so
it seems like so much of the references that you point to here, this is kind of like looking at the Bible through this particular lens, mm-hmm. finding these words and understanding, well, what is this talking about? Digging into it a little bit. What are the implications of that? You know, it'd be easy to kind of read over some of those things, but you dig in and you say, okay, well, what does that mean exactly? And you start to realize there's this whole kind of subtext to the whole Bible,
right?
Where you're teasing out these meanings, and it really is just a matter of accepting that the Bible says what it means what it says,
right? And every word was inspired, as Jesus Christ said, in the New Testament. And so you look at all those words and think, well, there's these musical terms in there the translators sort of were befuddled by, but they're in there. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, there is a lot about music there in the biblical text.
So one point that you make in the booklet is the sacrificial system of the Old Testament is something that was done away with, the sacrificing animals at the death of Jesus Christ. That sacrifice replaced those. But the musical aspect of worshiping God was there from the beginning. It was very much a part of the tabernacle and the temple service, and the temple in particular. Mm-hmm. And it was done then, and it's still done today. Maybe just tell us about the significance of that part of it being still around.
Right. Well, I think the book of Hebrews is an incredible book to illustrate how, well, first of all, Jesus Christ fulfilled all those Old Testament sacrifices, but yet he talks about, well, we still offer the sacrifice of praise and the fruit of our lips giving thanks and all those things. And the New Testament is still stressing song and singing, and it also even is stressing, well, how you sing in your heart. So there's even like the intent of what's behind the music you're doing. Mm. And so the New Testament, as is true to form for the New Testament, it's enhancing on the principles, even some of the physical principles outlined in the Old Testament. And so I just think that's fantastic that, well, even though the physical sacrifices are now fulfilled in Jesus Christ, well, you have the musical sacrifices, if you want to call them that, are still happening. The Old Testament even alludes to the fact that musical sacrifices were superior to the animals being sacrificed themselves. So the Old Testament's already alluding to this fact that this is what really pleases God. And then you go all the way up into the throne room, as is described in the book of Revelation, and you see, well, these things are happening in the throne room too. Mm. So the music was accompanying all those sacrifices, and even when those were replaced or done away, the music's still going, and it's still a huge part of the New Testament church. You come to the times we're living in now, when things are restored to the church, all things, and then the ruins are raised, you know, of the tabernacle of David, as it says, and then here music is such a key component of that effort.
Well, that's outstanding. We've been talking with Ryan Malone. He's the director of musical activities at Herbert W. Armstrong College. He's just produced a new booklet, How God Values Music. And let me just read some of the chapter titles here. Expanding the Throne Room Culture, talking about God's throne. Where did music come from? How advanced was biblical music? Music prior to the temple, music of the first and second temple periods, music in the New Testament. And then finally, the importance of music. It covers this subject of music in the Bible in an extraordinary way. And I would really encourage you to go online to thetrumpet.com and order a copy of this booklet, How God Values Music. Fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
American technology companies spend millions, even billions of dollars on research and development, and in many cases, the technologies they produce are subsequently stolen and reverse engineered illegally by China, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
Up to $8.8 billion worth of patented American technology was stolen by a Chinese state-owned company and its Taiwanese partner. That's according to a bombshell report recently unsealed by the United States Justice Department. The victim of the theft was Micron Technology Incorporated, an Idaho-based company that is the U.S.'s largest manufacturer of memory chips. Over the years, Micron has spent billions of dollars to develop something called Dynamic Random Access Memory Microchips, or DRAM chips. These DRAM chips are vital components of most electronic devices, such as smartphones, cars, and TVs. And Micron is actually America's only DRAM chip manufacturer. And DRAM chips make up by far the largest part of the company's operations. Around 70% of their $30 billion in revenue each year is generated by DRAM chip sales. For years, China has bought Micron's DRAM chips for use in Chinese electronics. But in 2016, The Chinese Communist Party said it was a national security priority to wean China off of its dependence on foreign technology, partly by making its own DRAM chips. That same year, the Chinese government gave close to $6 billion to a startup company called Fujian Jinhao Circuit Company. Fujian was given one purpose: to design and develop a Chinese DRAM chip. $6 billion goes a long way in the Chinese economy. So Fujian had plenty of funds and they had factory space, but what they didn't have was any viable knowledge about how to build these very high-tech DRAM chips. So Fujian partnered up with a Taiwanese company, a company called UMC, to help them. But the problem was UMC also lacked the necessary knowledge about how to make DRAM chips. So UMC's vice president, Qing Xing Kun, decided to look to Micron employees for help. Chen had previously worked for Micron Memory Taiwan, which is a subsidiary of the U.S. Micron company. And he enlisted several of his former co-workers to leave Micron for very lucrative jobs with UMC. But he didn't want them to make that transition empty-handed. The prosecutors in this case, prosecutors from both the U.S. and Taiwan, said that one of the employees from Micron Memory Taiwan brought with him, quote, trade secrets pertaining to the prior, current, and future generations of Micron's DRAM technology. Another recruit illegally downloaded 900 confidential and proprietary files from Micron servers and handed them over to UMC. Among the pilfered files were dozens of spreadsheets showing exact and detailed design specifications for various DRAM products. So these employees spent their last few days in a frenzied dash, just pilfering as much of Micron's confidential information as possible, and then they went to work for UMC and Fujian. And within a few months, miracle of miracles, the Chinese company Fujian was suddenly able to make DRAM chips. And they used them to compete against Micron in the open market. This was outright theft. It was a brazen scheme and highly illegal according to all kinds of international law. And what the Chinese and Taiwanese stole was worth up to $8.8 billion. Micron said this was, quote, one of the boldest schemes of commercial espionage in recent times. Yet the most alarming aspect of the DRAM theft incident is that it was not really that unusual. For more than a decade, Chinese theft of American commercial technology and intellectual property has become a pillar of China's economic growth. John Bennett, the special agent heading up the FBI's San Francisco office, told the LA Times on November 16th that China wants technology by hook or by crook, and the Chinese will do whatever it takes to steal it. On November 1st, Jeff Sessions, who was then the U.S. Attorney General, spoke about the Micron case and some similar cases and the broader trend of Chinese intellectual property theft. Here's a clip from that press briefing.
And when it comes to trade secret theft, we are currently prosecuting five other cases where the theft or attempted theft was for the benefit of the Chinese government. As the cases I have discussed have shown, Chinese economic espionage against the United States has been increasing, and it has been increasing rapidly.
So the scale of this threat is both impressive and frightening, and it has been increasing rapidly, as Mr. Sessions said there. Besides DRAM chips, the Chinese have also been caught stealing precious secrets regarding jet engines, wind turbine technology, biopharmaceutical products, and genetically modified rice. And even when China's operatives are caught and prosecuted, the nation's leadership is undeterred. John Bennett said, quote, they don't care if they get caught or if people go to jail. As long as it justifies their ends, they are not going to stop. End quote. And despite getting caught from time to time, as with the Micron case, the efforts as a whole are largely successful for China. China usually gets away with it, which we only know when they begin producing products that are obvious copies of the intellectual property and products of companies and the militaries from the U.S. and other nations. Politico wrote about this on May 22nd, saying, quote, "Again and again, high-tech products and military equipment have popped up in China that bear a too striking resemblance to their American counterparts." Experts say that altogether, China's intellectual property theft costs the United States between $225 billion and $600 billion each year. Every single year, on the high end of that estimate, that's $1,870 for every man, woman, and child in the United States every single year. More and more onlookers are coming to see just how serious China's ongoing assault is. But there's something far more momentous about China's theft of American property that very few experts recognize. And that is that this kind of theft was foretold in Bible scriptures written thousands of years ago. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are sometimes referred to as the Bible's blessings and curses chapters. These chapters discuss specific ways that God promised he would bless the nations of Israel if they obeyed him, and specific ways he promised that he would curse them if they chose to reject him. And Israel here refers mainly to the United States and Britain, which is thoroughly explained in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, by Herbert W. Armstrong. If we take a look at the politics, the entertainment, the education, the industry, and even the religion in the United States and the UK today, it's not hard to see that God is being rejected in almost every facet of life. Deuteronomy 28, verse 33 records one of the specific curses that God said he would send upon these nations if they rejected him. This passage says, "The fruit of your land and all your labors shall a nation which you know not eat up, and you shall be only oppressed and crushed always." On the Senate floor last year, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer discussed the endemic problem of China stealing American intellectual property, and he said, quote, "China continues to steal our family jewels, the things that have made America great, the intellectual property, the know-how in the highest-end industries. It makes no sense." In ordinary circumstances, Schumer would be correct in saying this ongoing nation-threatening thievery of the U.S.'s most prized knowledge and assets makes no sense. But since the United States was specifically prophesied in the Bible to have its fruit and its labors devoured by an enemy nation, because of that prophecy, the pattern we now see playing out makes perfect sense. America is rejecting God, and as a result, God is letting America become oppressed and crushed by a foreign power, exactly as he warned that he would in Deuteronomy 28, verse 33. But Bible prophecy doesn't stop there. The same Bible that accurately foretold America having its fruit and labors devoured by an enemy nation also says that thievery will not be allowed to go on indefinitely. Isaiah 65, verses 21 through 23 discuss a time in the future when the earth will be under God's government instead of under man's governments. And systematic theft, like the type that China is engaging in today, will be relegated to the dustbin of history. This passage says, quote, "And they shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are, the days of my people, and my elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain." This is a deeply inspiring picture of the future, and it can fill us with hope.
Very good stuff. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. So I'd like you, if you could talk a little bit more about these companies that, or it was the company that you referred to specifically, the Micron Technology
right.
Incorporated. What does it take for a company to put the kind of resources necessary to create these technologies?
Yeah, that's a huge part of this story. These companies are spending billions of dollars of research and development over a period of years, sometimes decades even, they're hiring the brightest scientists and engineers and developers and programmers of all kinds, and they're buying them the most expensive facilities and equipment and machinery and computer systems available. It's incredibly expensive and inefficient, mm-hmm. this kind of research and development. And so many of the individual projects won't bear any fruit for years. Mm-hmm. So the companies just keep on spending and spending. Many of the specific projects may never bear any fruit mm-hmm. or produce anything that is profitable. Mm-hmm. But then after long enough, if the company is patient enough and keeps on spending and spending enough, they'll produce something like these DRAM chips, which is revolutionizing life for everyone around the world, anyone with a smartphone, like or cars and TVs. So it's the research and development that's invested into these kinds of products is just enormous. Mm-hmm. So then to have China come in, pilfer it, just steal this technology quietly and reverse engineer it. And hey, we made these too.
Right. Yeah.
it's just nauseating to think of how much went into creating that product and then to have someone just steal it so flagrantly.
So you mentioned how what China has done here violates all kind of international law, but then you said they also don't face real stiff penalties for that. Can you just talk about the enforcement protocols that are in place or what kind of policing there is on this and why China is still coming out way ahead on this?
Yes, I'm not an expert in World Trade Organization law, but there are specific clauses and laws of all kinds that protect intellectual property, and that's across borders. But the problem with international law is who's going to enforce it.
Yeah.
So China and Russia, especially, these are, the WTO is connected to the United Nations, but China and Russia have Security Council status. They have veto status in the United mm-hmm. Nations. If there's ever a case that comes against them in any sort of international law body, WTO or the United Nations, any sort of measures that come against them that they don't like, they can wield their veto power. But what most often happens is before it gets to that point, they just ignore those laws mm-hmm. because there's very little ramification for ignoring them. Mm-hmm. There's not a good mechanism in place to enforce. You know, the U.S. can say, stop doing this, we're not going to trade with you, which is what really a big part of the trade war that's happening right now between the U.S. and China. President Trump has often mentioned China's ongoing espionage and theft of America's intellectual property. So that is one consequence, and that is beginning to bite the Chinese economy in some ways, but it's difficult. And China can always turn to other countries because there's not a unified international system to really say you must abide by these laws.
Right. And so there is an element of just playing by the rules and self-policing in a sense, and just having enough respect for the other nations that you're going to honor that, that the policing mechanism isn't enough to prevent that from happening if someone is determined to do it. So prophetically, you were talking about the fact that the United States in accordance with what we read in Leviticus 26, that there are these prophecies that specifically talk about not eating the fruit of your own labor, that type of thing. Is there any significance to China being the offending party here?
There is, yes. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has written quite a lot in his booklet Isaiah's End Time Vision and elsewhere about the rise of China and about how that was prophesied in Bible scriptures written thousands of years ago. Ezekiel, Revelation, Daniel, numerous other books talk about China and even name China, using ancient names for it, such as Magog and Chittim, things like that, showing that this power will rise up in the end time. There's also passages in Isaiah 23 that talk about China being part of a mart of nations that ends up besieging the United States and forms this economic besiegement against it. So the what we're seeing right now really is a fulfillment of that. You know, I think in a way that specific prophecy about U.S. fruits being eaten by a foreign nation, but it also really is part of the fulfillment of China's rise, which is mentioned in numerous Bible scriptures.
Well, we appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. He has an article up on thetrumpet.com, China Steals U.S. Trade Secrets and Fulfills Bible Prophecy. It also references that Isaiah's end time vision and points to the trend of China becoming a superpower, all of which you can read on thetrumpet.com, or you can order a free copy of that booklet by Gerald Fleury. Really fascinating. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
In many parts of the world, there's been an increase in climatic, weather-related, and geological disasters, including Australia. This has been slammed with dust storms, fire tornadoes, floods, and heat waves just in recent weeks. To talk about this, we have via Skype from Australia, trumpet writer Callum Wood. Hello, Callum.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to hear from you again. So tell us about just the recent disasters that you've been experiencing down there.
Well, as you mentioned there's been a string of them over the last 2 weeks. It's started with some torrential downpours and rain in Sydney. And in each of these cases, we're talking about things that are historic. A lot of the news reporters say they're unusual, historic, record-breaking. It's extreme. There's mayhem and chaos. These aren't just the common every year you sort of see these things roll around. It's not that way at all. In fact, a lot of the time, these natural disasters that we're going to talk about here today are they're record breaking and highly unusual, even for recent years when we've seen a lot of weather disasters in the region. So the first off was as I mentioned, the torrential rain in Sydney. Now Sydney received a month's worth of rain in a single hour.
Wow.
Which of course, led to incredible flooding, a lot of property damage. There was some loss of life. It wasn't a lot, but there were casualties. I think somebody who was part of one of the rescue crews died, and there have been some fatalities since that time as well. But Sydney was pummeled with this incredible amount of rain that came down in a single hour. And that was just the start. Sydney also was hit in the last 2 weeks. They were hit with a major dust storm, and the conditions to allow for a dust storm of this size are very rare. You have to have a lot of factors that seem to have to line up together, including high winds and the right temperatures. And so an enormous dust cloud, it was the size of the state of Tasmania, the island just to the south of the mainland Australia there. And this descended right on the capital city, which of course forced the grounding of hundreds of planes. It cost the taxpayers mega dollars simply because of the damage it caused. And of course there are health issues related to that. Mm-hmm. There obviously for people suffering with asthma and similar respiratory problems, the dust storm that comes in, it just tends to choke up whatever area it descends on. And so, of course, the ramifications have been a lot of health issues from that. And we've even seen it as far north as Queensland, the dust causing a lot of visibility issues, even as far north as Brisbane.
Okay. And so you talked about the flooding and the dust storms. You've also had fire tornadoes.
That's right. Well, that's the fires that have been hitting Australia at the moment have been terrible. We've had, just in the state of Queensland, there was 100 fires that were burning out of control in the last 2 weeks, covering a stretch of coastline about 2,000 kilometers long. The fires, they were down as far as Brisbane, and they extended way up north. And, of course, a lot of the areas, the further north you go, are very remote, and there's a lot of bushland. So, again, the loss of life wasn't great, but certainly there was a lot of property damage. A lot of people had to be evacuated from the smaller towns and settlements up north. And a lot of these fires are just very hard to control simply because they are happening in remote areas. And the weather, it just seems to be working against the fire crews. We've had unusually high wind, and it's been blowing a gale here in Brisbane and up north. Hot, dry winds. And for this time of year, we would expect it to be a little bit more humid than it is now, which of course helps just suppress those fires just a little bit. But instead of that, we've been getting this really hot, dry wind, which just helps to fan the flames. And as well as that, the weather, another unique phenomenon that doesn't happen all the time, is occurring, and that is dry lightning, when we have these thunderstorms that roll through. But because of the weather conditions, I'm no meteorologist, I don't know the science behind it exactly, but weather conditions have to align in a very certain way so that when the thunderstorms roll through, they, rather than drop any rain at all, they instead just bring on the thunder and lightning, which of course leads to even more bushfires starting up. And yeah, so we've seen this here in Queensland. We've also seen it stretched across inland Australia and even as far as Western Australia or down the, in Central and South Australia as well.
Well, all of these weather disasters don't seem to have prevented the songbirds down there from continuing to sing, so that's good news. But so, how are the media? How are the politicians? How are people responding to this confluence of disasters that are happening?
Well, there's no surprises there, that's for sure. The same response comes from all of these weather disasters. And the droughts and the flooding and the heat waves, whenever they roll through, we always see the same excuse, and that is, of course, climate change. A lot of news reporters and such speak with a lot of urgency. They talk about the need for us to pay attention and to make changes because we are faced with an incredible threat of climate change.
Okay, so the way that they're talking about it, they're pointing to, say, the need to reduce greenhouse gases, carbon emissions. You have written an article for thetrumpet.com, Australia Cursed with Unnatural Disasters. Maybe you can just give us a bigger picture.
Absolutely. Well, in the article, I obviously talk about some of these things that have been happening here in Australia, these historic weather events. But rather than and take the approach that we see from scientists and a lot of academics and those in the mainstream media, politicians, instead we need to look to other aspects of accountability. Now, the danger, as I write in this article, the danger is when we put all of the blame squarely on the shoulders of climate change, it makes our own personal role in it very, very minimal when you're considering climate change and your part in all of this and my part in all of this. When we blame climate change, that means that that our part in preventing that might be as simple as cleaning out our gutters or keep maintaining a fire break at our home to prevent bushfires from rolling through easily, or it might mean using cleaner fuels or buying a Tesla. Who knows? It depends on how much money you have, I guess. But other things like not using plastic, single-use plastic bags, that's a big topic here in Australia at the moment. Even a lot of the convenience stores and such have banned the use of plastic straws because they're too harmful to the environment. So when we put the blame on climate change, well, instantly that makes our role in all of this very easy to overcome. It makes it quite simple. Well, if I want to help do my part, I stop buying single-use plastic bags or these things that are damaging to the environment and try and limit my quote-unquote carbon footprint. But as the Trumpet has reported on repeatedly, climate change is not to blame. I mean, the climate certainly changes, but it's not the result of greenhouse gases or mankind throwing plastic bags in the ocean. Instead, the problem traces a lot further back, and it, of course, traces back to the Bible.
You know, I was thinking about this. We recently had a report issued by the Trump administration about basically the way that the media has reported on it. It's said that that there are elements within officials within the Trump administration who are kind of catching up to the scientific consensus that there is man-made climate change, that the only way to prevent a future apocalypse of destruction, climatic and geological destruction, is to reduce our carbon emissions and so on, that there is virtual unanimity in the scientific community that this is the cause for all of those problems. And finally, we have voices of reason emerging within this barbaric administration in America that is that are going to help to catch America up to the rest of the world. It's quite amazing, though, just how the way that they talk about it. There's absolutely no doubt, no question whatsoever in their minds what the cause of this is. And yet, if you dig into the data a bit more, you find that what they're speaking of as a consensus is actually nothing of a consensus at all, that there are quite a lot of voices out there that are saying this is far too complex for us to pin the blame on a single cause such as carbon emissions, that there may be, that may be one factor among 10,000 or maybe 10 million factors that would be calculated into a correct climatological model. So what you're looking at, you said that rather than pinpointing the blame on one cause like that, that you're going back to the Bible. And explain what you mean in terms of what the cause of these climatic disasters is.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as I mentioned, you can trace it all the way back to the Bible. Now, a lot of people, even perhaps some religious people in the world, might be a bit dubious about that. They might even scoff at it somewhat. And oftentimes that's just simply a result of people not being able to reconcile a loving God with a drought or a heat wave or a fire. Why would a loving God allow something like that? But of course, if we let God answer that for himself, we can see in the pages of the Bible exactly why God allows these things to happen, why he brings these curses on our nations. And the greatest example to turn to, of course, if people wanted to pull out their Bible and to look at why God allows these things to happen, would be to turn to Leviticus 26. Leviticus 26 is often referred to as the blessings and cursings chapter. And in the start of the chapter, God talks about the blessings that he can bestow upon a nation, the way that he can build up a nation, that he can bless the land and bless the increase if the people are obedient and if they obey, if they follow the commands of their maker. But notice as well, the end of the chapter, God delivers a very dire warning to people. And in verse 14, God recorded here, "But if you will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments," and then God had recorded here all of these examples of the curses that would come on a nation if they didn't obey and didn't keep God's commands. And some of these, you can look at the Australian outback today and say, well, that's case in point with so many of these, simply because you can read in, say, verse 19, "And I'll break the pride of your power, and I'll make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass." Well, at the moment, Australia's going through some terrible heat waves and some crippling drought in major portions of the nation. God says if we fail to obey his commands, that he brings these things on us. And so that's why if people would go back to the Bible and to read these things for themselves, they can see here. They can see exactly why God would allow this. And obviously we don't have the time to delve into a lot of examples right now, but we do have a book that the church produces. It's called Why Natural Disasters. It's free. You can order it on request. There might be a link in the show notes. And this book goes into great detail as to why God allows these things to happen and the purpose behind them.
Yeah, there are so many, many verses in the Bible that talk about this. That booklet goes into quite a lot of detail on many of them. And it's one of those things where you either accept what the Bible says about it, or you pretty much have to throw the Bible out, because it's not just one or two isolated passages. It's really all the way through the Bible. We have that booklet, Why Natural Disasters. We also have a trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Increased Natural and Weather Disasters. We'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. But if you have not studied into this subject in the Bible, this is a really important subject to study, especially in light of how much you hear about this quote-unquote consensus within the scientific community. And it seems like the pressure and the intellectual bullying against anyone who would pose an alternative perspective has grown very fierce. And it's one of those things where unless you really know what it is that forms the foundation of your belief, if you have not really studied into it, then you're absolutely going to go along with what they're saying is the consensus. And what's so important about that Why Natural Disasters booklet, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has actually put in some additional material in a recent update to that booklet that we did that talks specifically about this climate change view that's being pushed so strongly that it is essentially undercutting the potency of the warning that is contained. You were talking about the fact that these disasters really are warnings from God. They are curses that are coming about as a result of our sins. And if you're not even looking at that as a cause, if you throw the Bible out and you're being blindsided, or you're being caught up in this view that that it's all caused by carbon emissions or whatever, those types of issues that are being discussed, you're never going to see what's really going on here, and it's going to blunt the effectiveness of that corrective sword. So it is really important that that you look into this for yourself and prove it for yourself. We've been talking with trumpet writer Callum Wood about his recent article. It's going up on the Trumpet site now. Australia cursed with unnatural disasters. Several disasters occurring and mounting up in Australia in recent weeks. Callum, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's time for today's last word.
There are times when I'm home concentrating on something that I'm working on, and I'll suddenly realize that one of my children has been trying unsuccessfully for some time to get my attention. And in those moments, I get flashbacks to my youth competing with a newspaper for my own father's attention. Dad, 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 I just wrecked your car. Dad, I just gambled away my savings. Dad. Oh, hi, Joel. What were you saying? I'm just joking, of course. I never wrecked the car or gambled. But are all parents this way? It's easy for us to fall into this pattern when a child, generally a young child, calls your name five times before you even have a chance to respond. Daddy, 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 daddy. But I suspect that it's a circular problem. Would my child be so inclined to repeat herself incessantly if she could rely on a response from me the first time? If I granted her the same level of attentiveness that I give to adults? I flinch when I realize how I hold my children to a higher standard in listening than I hold myself. I'm a firm believer in training your children to be attentive to your voice and to ensure that they respond after being spoken to one time. You make sure you speak loudly enough for your children to hear you, and then you expect them to respond. Children can easily pretend not to hear, or they can simply tune us out if they have more important things to do, quote unquote. You have to apply consequences for this. But then this training should be accompanied by our own solid habit of attentiveness. After all, if our children are inclined to ignore us, shouldn't we ask ourselves whether it might be because we've taught them carefully by example to do so? Now, one argument against this might be, well, it's more important for them to listen to me. They're the children, and I'm the adult. And in one sense, that's true. But consider the bigger picture for a moment. God the Father is a perfect listener. And in the Bible, He instructs us to pray daily, and He just listens to us. He's careful to ensure that our communication reaches His ear. Scripture speaks of angels carrying incense mixed with the prayers of the saints right up to the golden altar before God's throne. Jesus Christ serves as high priest and intercessor for the saints, bringing our petitions before God. So communication is clearly important to God. Have you ever felt you had to do a song and dance to get God's attention? Has He ever been too preoccupied to hear you? It's easy with a child to say no as a knee-jerk reaction, especially when he or she makes 10,000 requests a day. But think about it. Do you ever get the feeling that God says, "Don't you think you've asked for enough already?" God never shuts us out. He carefully considers each request. And it's important to realize that God intends that we as parents fulfill a type of the role that He fulfills in our lives. A physical father teaches his children about their spiritual father by his own example. And if his example is good and strong, those children will grow to have a much easier time relating to God the Father. So maybe we can give some thought to what we're teaching our children about the God we pray to by how attentive and responsive we ourselves are to them. In his book called The God Family Vision, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, wrote this: "Parents, how will you prepare your children for God's work? You have a major responsibility to get them ready for that, to teach those little children why family, why marriage, why children, to declare the Father to them." Well, one way to declare the Father to our children is to show them by example what a wonderful listener He really is. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Ryan Malone, Jeremiah Jacques, and Callum Wood. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Nan Fairbrother: "The hardest of all is learning to be a well of affection and not a fountain, to show them we love them not when we feel like it, but when they do." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.